The Big Journey from Creation to New Creation. This is a Bible teaching series that will take you all the way through the Bible, from the creation account in Genesis to John's vision of the new creation in the book of Revelation. This series is brought to you by creationtonewcreation.com. Adam and Eve were in exile, outside God's paradise. Satan was now, in Jesus' words, the ruler of this world. His kingdom had a foothold on earth. But what did Satan want to do here on earth? Satan is arrogant and proud. There can be no doubt that he wants to be like God himself. That may well be confirmed by something Isaiah prophesied against the king of Babylon. I'm reading from Isaiah 14. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. Above the stars of God I will set my throne on high. I will make myself like the Most High. This prophecy is very likely to have a double reference, a reference to Satan as well as to the king of Babylon. Satan had failed to achieve his ambition in heaven. He couldn't make himself like the Most High God there. God cast him out from his presence. But now Satan, it seems, saw another chance to be like God, this time here on planet Earth. He saw his chance to rule Earth as if he were God, and that involved trying to copy what God was planning to do here on Earth. And what was God planning to do here? In a previous talk, we saw that God called mankind to complete his world project. God commissioned mankind to colonize this planet, subdue it, and make it a paradise where God lived amongst us. So Satan began to inspire mankind to complete this world project, but without God. Instead, Satan himself wanted to be this world's God. Satan dreamt of a godless utopia, an ideological, political, and economic system united under his domination and in rebellion against God. The writer H.G. Wells captured this humanistic vision in his book, A Short History of the World. In it, he wrote this: Can we doubt that presently our race will more than realize our boldest imaginations, that it will achieve unity and peace, that it will live in a world made more splendid and lovely than any palace or garden that we know, going on from strength to strength in an ever-widening circle of adventure and achievement? The great question was this: Can fallen mankind, governed by Satan, really bring paradise to this world without God? God will not wind up history before this question is fully answered. So God allows Satan to continue to try to unfold his evil plans, plans that will climax in the career of the final Antichrist at the end of this age. But at the same time, our sovereign God is at work. Through the ages, God has been outworking his amazing plan of redemption for mankind. And so human history continued. Eve gave birth to two boys, Cain the firstborn, and Abel. The two brothers each offered a sacrifice to God, but the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. God didn't accept Cain's sacrifice. Was it because Cain didn't offer an animal? Not necessarily. The text doesn't imply this. It's because Abel offered his in faith, as we read in Hebrews 11. Abel's heart was right with God. He offered God a firstborn of the flock and the fat. Now, we don't value an animal's fat very highly today, but back then it was the choicest part of the animal. Abel offered God the very best he could bring. In contrast, Cain just brought an offering of the fruit of the ground. There's no indication that his offering was the best of his crop. His heart wasn't right with God. That would shortly be demonstrated beyond all doubt by his murder of Abel. And we see it too in his truculent rejoinder to God. How should I know? Am I supposed to be my brother's guardian? So God couldn't accept Cain's offering. Cain was angry. But see how graciously God deals with him. God said, Why are you angry, and why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. God wanted to turn Cain's heart away from anger. He wanted to bring him back to himself. But despite God's entreaty, Cain's anger exploded. He murdered his brother. Abel's body lay lifeless. The devil, a murderer from the beginning, had sown the spirit of murder into Cain's heart. There was no capital punishment in those days. Instead, God placed Cain under a curse. What is a curse? A curse is the opposite of blessing. A cursed life is a pointless life. It's a life that ultimately counts for nothing. Cain and his family now had no place in God's purposes for this world, and in fact his whole family line came to a dead end at the flood. Cain would now find it difficult to scratch a living from the soil. This was a step beyond God's judgment on Adam. Cain was condemned to be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth. The commentator Victor Hamilton says, "In some ways, it is a fate worse than death. It is to lose all sense of belonging and identification with a community." Nevertheless, God showed Cain mercy. He placed a mark on him. This was to protect him. Derek Kidner comments, "It is the utmost that mercy can do for the unrepentant." God even promised to avenge anyone who murdered Cain the murderer. Cain now went away from the presence of the Lord. He settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. He built a city. Perhaps this was to defy God's judgment on him, to cease being a fugitive and to settle down in security and build a society of his own. So Cain began to establish, in Bernard Bell's words, an alternative society, a godless society away from God's presence. His descendants mastered the skills of animal husbandry, music and metalworking. Technology and the arts, foundations of civilization, flourished. But alongside this sophistication, there was violence. Cain's ancestor, Lamech, threatened revenge on any who dared oppose him. Sin began to spiral out of control. God provided Adam and Eve with another son to take Abel's place. Eve called him Seth, saying, "God has appointed for me another offspring instead of Abel." Notice that she called Seth another offspring. That word offspring reminds us of God's promise in Genesis 3, verse 15. Seth was an ancestor of the promised offspring Jesus, the offspring of Eve who would crush Satan's head. Seth had a son, Enosh. At that time, people began to call upon the name of the Lord. It seems that some people, perhaps Seth's family, began to worship God at this time. Enosh's great-great-grandson Enoch walked with God. Enoch never died, rather God simply translated him into his presence in heaven. Enoch's grandson was another Lamech, but he was a complete contrast to the Lamech descended from Cain. Instead of threatening violent revenge, this Lamech yearned for relief from the curse on the ground. Lamech named his son Noah, a name derived from a Hebrew verb which means to rest, to settle down. When he named Noah, Lamech said, "This one shall bring us relief from our work and from the painful toil of our hands." Lamech longed for a world without painful toil, a world at rest. And Lamech's desire for a world at rest was fulfilled. His son Noah is a direct ancestor of Jesus, the one who indeed brings rest to this world. But sin spiraled out of control. Evil, loathsome and depraved, flooded the earth. Genesis 6, verses 2 and 4 tell us that the sons of God lusted after beautiful human girls and married them. The offspring of these sons of God were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. These mighty men were great and famous warriors. The passage also mentions the mysterious Nephilim. This name likely means fallen ones. These Nephilim may perhaps be these mighty men. Who were these sons of God? We can't be certain. The most likely scenario is that they were evil angels. These angels were having sexual relations with human women. Pagan sources provide evidence for this very thing. In Greek mythology, we find tales of sexual relations between gods and humans. For example, Hercules, famous for his strength, was said to be the son of the god Zeus and the mortal Alcmene. It may be that these pagan myths are corrupted memories of actual events, events that are recorded here in Genesis. If this indeed is what was going on, then these evil angels had crossed a God-given boundary between angels and humans. It was monstrous wickedness. This crossing of a boundary may well be what Jude is referring to in his New Testament letter when he speaks about angels who did not stay within their own position of authority, but left their proper dwelling. This seems to be confirmed by what Jude says next. He says that these angels' sin was like the sexual immorality and unnatural desire of the inhabitants of Sodom and Gomorrah. They too had transgressed a God-given sexual boundary. And if angels were indeed having sexual relations with humans, then their offspring would have been hybrids, part human, part angelic, and so the whole human race was in danger of being contaminated and degraded, including the ancestors of Eve's offspring, whom God had promised, the offspring who would bruise Satan's head. In short, it seems likely that what these evil angels were doing would have jeopardized God's whole plan of salvation for mankind. It likely threatened to bring mankind irretrievably under satanic control. The earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. The Lord was sorry that he had made mankind. His heart was grieved. So in his mercy, the Lord stepped in to stem the hellish tide of sin. He said, "I will blot out man, whom I have created, from the face of the land, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens." But among the mass of corrupt humanity, there was a righteous man, Noah. Noah was a man of faith. He walked with God. God made plans to save Noah and his family. And God said to him, "I will establish my covenant with you." Through Noah and his family, God was going to preserve the human race and continue his plan of salvation. God told Noah to build an enormous boat. In this vessel, Noah and his immediate family, together with a whole menagerie of creatures, would be saved. God gave Noah the blueprint. The ark had good, seaworthy proportions. It was large enough to give it stability in the churning floodwaters. The project must have taken decades. Doubtless faithful Noah endured years of mockery from unbelievers as he laboured on this project. The day came when God told Noah to board the ark with his family and all the animals. God himself shut the door. Rain fell, and the fountains of a great deep gushed out for 40 days. Then the floodwaters subsided. The ground dried out. The day came when God gave the command to disembark. Notice how the account of the flood echoes the creation account in Genesis 1. Firstly, Genesis 1 verse 2 tells us that the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Primeval earth was submerged by water. The flood returned earth to that original condition. Secondly, Genesis 1 verse 2 tells us that the Spirit of God was hovering over the earth. After the flood, God sent a wind over the earth. The Hebrew word for wind here is ruach, exactly the same word translated spirit in Genesis 1 verse 2. Thirdly, after the flood, the waters receded and dry land appeared, just as they did on the third creation day. The earth after the flood was like a new, clean planet. It was like a new creation. The ark came to rest. Noah, his family, and the animals stepped out onto a cleansed land. Noah's first act was to sacrifice burnt offerings to God. Then God said to Noah, "I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood." The sign of that covenant was a rainbow. This is the first time that we meet the word covenant in the Bible. Through the Bible, God made a number of covenants with people. Covenants are to do with relationship. The covenant partners enter into a relationship with each other. God's relationship with mankind was broken at the fall. Through this covenant and the succeeding covenants that we encounter through the Bible, God outworked his plan to bring mankind back into relationship with himself. God promised never to send another flood like the Genesis flood. There have been many catastrophic floods since that day, of course, but there has never been another flood like that one. What that flood achieved has never needed repeating. So what did God achieve through the flood? Of course, it didn't solve the problem of human sin. After the flood, the intention of man's heart was still evil from his youth. But if it was true, as seems likely, that evil angels were having unlawful relations with people, then the flood would have put an end to this. The flood would have destroyed all the half-human offspring of these wicked angels, and so it would have prevented the human race from being contaminated, and in turn, therefore, it would have removed the threat of a coming of a promised offspring, Jesus Christ. An offspring of Eve would indeed one day be born and crush Satan's head. Noah was like another Adam, stepping out into a new world. God blessed Adam and Eve. He blessed Noah. And what God said to Noah echoes his words to Adam and Eve. Firstly, God commanded Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Likewise, he commanded Noah and his sons, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Secondly, God gave Adam and Eve dominion over the animals. Now God gave every beast, bird and fish into the hands of Noah and his sons. Thirdly, God appointed food for Adam and Eve, every plant yielding seed and every tree with seed in its fruit. Now he appointed food for Noah and his family. He said, every moving thing that lives shall be food for you, and as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. But though God allowed Noah and his family to eat animals, he forbade them to consume blood. Why? Blood is the vehicle of life. Leviticus 17 verse 11 says, the life of the flesh is in the blood. Blood represents life, and life is from God. So to show respect for life and respect for God who gave that life, blood wasn't to be consumed during the Old Testament age. But the world after the flood was still a fallen world. Violence was still an ugly fact of life. God took account of this. Animals now lived in fear of mankind, perhaps both to reduce their threat to us and our threat to them. And God now instituted the death penalty for a murderer. In our next talk, we'll look at what happened after the flood until the time that we meet a man called Abraham. Through this faithful man, God continued to outwork his plan of salvation for this world.